I think two laypersons from a rather conservative denomination, two different denominations, are arguing the finer points of biblical hermeneutics. And the one says to the other, "Why, you don't even go to a Bible-believing church like I do." And the other one retorts, "Why, you're a biblical illiterate. Was it last week that you said an apostle was the epistle's wife?" And she says, "Why, no. In fact, you can't even say the Lord's Prayer from memory." And the defender said, "I can too. Let's put some money on it." So they put $20 each on the table, and she folded her arms to watch the person do the Lord's Prayer. And he thought for a moment, and he said, "Now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. When in the morning light I wake, show me the path of love to take." And she bowed her head, and she said, "Well, I'll take your money. I didn't think you could do that." Folks, if nothing else in this message today, and I've spoken all over Southern California, many other messages, but this is the main one. Most Western people are completely unaware of their faith system's origins, the coherence of it, and how it all fits or doesn't fit together. We've all heard people argue ad infinitum some fine difference of biblical interpretation. But the question I pose to you and hope to answer and have for myself, and it's helped many hundreds across Southern California, is at least for the conservative of any particular denomination, does it all hang together? In Christian language, since I know that best, but it would also apply to the Quran with Islam, in Christian language, are the 66 books of the Protestant canon necessarily inerrant, without error, in all areas of zoology and morality and theology and spirituality, in order for there to be a God concept that is real and accurate? And the conservative says, "Duh, yes, of course." To which most liberals, including all my seminary professors, are, "Oh, Mike, come on. God is much bigger than any one particular text. God is much broader than any one particular source of revealed religion. You just need to grow up and be more open-minded and tolerant." To which the conservative, rightly, I believe, as a secular humanist today, says, "I don't think so." The majority of Western culture are in a huge paradigm shift, and some of them are quite content and rational in what they believe. Others are scared spitless, and they need to be. They need to be because their belief system is based on the premise that this book tells me the truth, not just about God, but about who I am, and about whether there should or should not be guilt or sin or salvation or an afterlife, whether I even have a nephesh, a soul, psuche in Greek, which is psychology, where I am now a therapist. And if it's errant in some way, everything I believe may suddenly fall apart on me. And for many, that's why you see them so tenaciously hanging on to the beliefs that are tied together, abortion rights and ordination of gays into ministry and the rights of homosexual couples to marry and God we trust on currency and in the Pledge of Allegiance. All these things are tied together. The passion of Christ, the beheading of someone we know is going to happen next week because a different belief system has the same premise. This book tells me everything I need to know. If you tell me it's wrong in one thing, it's wrong in everything, and I may not even exist as I understand myself to be, so I'll follow it every jot and tittle, to use two Greek terms. And so we did. I'm really grateful, Martins, for the invitation to be with you. So the first major point on your outline, and I will follow the outline fairly carefully, is that for many, not all, but for many people, certainly the majority of Western culture, biblical heresy does lead to atheism. They rationally believe that. I happen to believe they're correct. If they don't know it too much by reason, they intuit that this is where it would lead them. And it's not because they're narrow-minded or bigoted. It's because they understand that the source from which they derive their faith claims to be inerrant, without error, and their entire pilgrimage from the days 4,000 years of recorded history in the Judeo-Christian canon teach them the same. Here's a little poking fun, but also makes the point. In seminary, you learn a lot of those who disagree with that view, and this is according to the gospel of Paul Tillich, Rudolf Bultmann, the great German theologian, and Albert Schweitzer, the secular humanist of his day. And here's the quote from those gospels. Jesus said unto them, "And who do you say that I am?" And Peter answered, "You are the eschatological manifestation of the ground of our being, the ontological foundation of the context of our very selfhood revealed." And Jesus said, "Say what?" Well, the reason that somewhat humorous, but if there would be, they're very unlikely to be a conservative believer here, a conservative Christian believer here. But for them to hear that, it would be blasphemy. Because the truth of the matter is, 80% of the seminaries in the United States know that it is as likely that Peter said that as that he said what the Bible declares him to have said, which is, "Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God." Peter didn't say that, Peter never thought that, Jesus never asked that question, and almost all seminaries, other than places like Talbot or so, or Dallas Theological Seminary, know that and teach their seminary students that. The first major sub-point for the first major point is that there is a great deal of consciously, deliberately deceptive writing in the Bible, and I'm going to refer primarily to the New Testament because that's my training and my own pilgrimage, but it would apply to the Old Testament and also to the Quran, which are the three documents that are the source of all monotheism. I will never forget the angst that began a swarm for me that lasted for 20 years, when after being converted to Christianity through Christian apologetics and knowing every Christian apologist from the 2nd century through the 80s, and understanding the mathematical probabilities of Old Testament prophecies coming true in Jesus and all the rest, I sat down for my first changing from dentistry to pre-ministerial and heard in New Testament 101 the synoptic problem revealed. There were mostly men in the class, and there are many, many women today, but he began as professor, "Gentlemen, it's not that anyone lied to you." And people of faith, I'll never forget my gut response was, "I'm not so sure about that." For those who may not be familiar with the synoptic problem, it is why the synoptics, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, though they use the same exact source documents and even write from each other, especially Mark being the prototype for Matthew and Mark, or Matthew and Luke, why they differ in substantive detail as to what Jesus is alleged to have done, said, the order of events, whether particular stories ever occurred in reality at all. And the thought that crossed my mind at that point, and which I began to, in psychological language, we would call react against or reaction formation against it, was that, wait a minute, if they did do these things and changed orders and felt at liberty to add to and delete and alter words and rewrite history in order to attune to them, to their own readership, doesn't that mean that Jesus really isn't God? That Jesus never even maybe believed he was the Messiah? That all of this is just one, at that point, is it just a story? I was scared, and there was reason for me to be afraid, but it would take another 15 years before I would be relaxed enough to look at their other alternatives to faith. So in one sentence, there is credible reason to believe that for the conservative, if they were to allow for gays to be ordained and be acceptable in terms of just another lifestyle, that their very idea that I'm a soul would also disappear. And I have to believe that they're correct until they come to a place of postmodernism, which we'll refer to in a minute. My favorite text at that time, because I was in reaction formation, was 2 Peter 1:16. Listen carefully. 2 Peter 1:16. The writer says, "For we did not follow cleverly devised tales when we made known to you the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, but we were eyewitnesses of his majesty." And I used to think, right on, Peter, that's exactly right. But by the time I was second year at School Theology at Claremont, I found out Peter didn't even write that. 1 Peter probably was written, we think, by the Apostle Peter. 2 Peter is seminary language, a part of the pseudepigrapha, the false writings. It was very common in the 2nd century for writers to bring the clout of apostolic authorship to communicate a new truth. They would have said, "Baba Ruach Hadesh, the Holy Spirit inspired them," you know. But they felt perfectly at ease to deceive their readership and believe it was written by the Apostle. And again, this is something that the vast majority of seminaries teach their students, which we're taught, some of them taught in seminary to not tell our congregations. I can laugh about that today, but I'm serious. There was a time that was very painful for me. Here's a bit of humor that isn't painful. It's why God never received tenure at a university is sort of what you're talking about. The reason God never got tenure at a university is because God's one major publication had ghostwriters behind it. It wasn't published first in a respected journal. God never sought the cooperative efforts of his colleagues. In fact, it was one work that was published. He claims not to have any colleagues worthy of his stature. The scientific community has not been able to replicate God's experimental results. He never applied to the ethics board to get permission to use human subjects. That's worthy itself. When one early experiment went awry, he drowned all of his subjects to cover it. Over 2,000 years of working with subjects when they did not behave as desired, he deleted them from the sample, often via horrific deaths, and always without benefit of anesthesia. He rarely came to class and told students, just read the book. Some say he had his son teach the class, but those of us who are physiologists argue that was primarily in the second semester. He expelled his first two students for learning. His office hours were infrequent, usually held on remote mountaintops and limited to by invitation only. And finally, of the 10 requirements for his final exam, not one student ever passed but one. And we believe there was a great deal of nepotism in that final grade. Well, it's somewhat poking fun, but there's a serious flavor to that I hope you hear. There is a great deal of consciously and deliberately deceptive writing in the canon of Scripture, which leads me to my second sub-point. My own faith journey, and for many new users, I've spoken across the Southern California area in similar stages. Prior to the undergraduate school, I was convinced that all 66 books were absolutely infallible and inerrant. Could not be wrong in any particular area. As I sat in that New Testament 101 class, I began to shift quickly to stage two, which is, it is infallible and it's inerrant, but on almost everything, not exactly everything. So at that point, my battle cry might have been, the reliability of the Bible is not dependent upon the edibility of Jonah. And 2 years later, with some more exposure to biblical criticism, and having gotten by that point into seminary, I began to believe that, it's not inerrant. You know, there's a great deal of things that are not accurate, intended not to be accurate, intended to confuse and deceive. But I, like the writers, am filled with the Holy Spirit, and the Ruach HaKodesh would lead me into truth, just as it did the writers that penned those words. And then probably, I'm somewhat ashamed about this, I've got through my own psychological stuff on this, but probably about 4 years before I left the ministry, I knew I was consciously and deliberately myself an atheist, and I was in stage four, and I went through tremendous pain and struggle. My family are all conservative to this day, as I began to say, well, none of it's true. And John says, God is love. He's wrong. Not only is God not love, God is also lie. It's all just one big lie. And it's incumbent upon me, among the millions of clergy who've gone before me, or at least hundreds of thousands, to continue the deception of my people, because if they knew the truth, their lives like mine would fall apart. And I was very heavily in the cubicle of penalty those years of my ministry, from which I've recovered today, in the years of sobriety and clean time. But I'll tell you, it was very, very painful to have my wife stand there leading praise music, the lyrics to which I had written, and she knew that not one word that her godly husband was teaching was the truth. And she knew that I didn't believe it, and I didn't know what else to do. And there are many clergy in that category today that are moderately conservative. What happened was I finally came to stage five to come to believe through postmodernism, which I'll explain in a minute. Wait a minute, it is a story. But so is postmodernism. So is Buddhism. So is everything human beings have always believed. We base our knowledge on myth and folklore and narrative and stories and fables and analogies and comparisons. And it's beautiful and it's glorious. It's not a story that works for me anymore, too sure. But it's one glorious story among many. And that allowed me to begin to relate again to my family in a different way. And for the first time since New Testament 101, I began to be able to trust in what I would call a 12-step language, a higher power, but actually trust. So, for those of you who struggle in some area of your life, I have to ask the question in loving confrontation. Do you believe what you say you believe? Are you able to put your faith or confidence into that system? Is it working for you? Because if it's not working, you need to look carefully at how comfortable you are with your belief system. Here's the story that sort of illustrates that and allows for some breathing room for us. There's a crew working a along the side of the road, and they're trying to dig through this trench to get some plumbing laid down, and they come up on a rather impressive power cable cord. They don't know whether to cut through it or not. About that time, the power company truck was rolling by. So the poor person calls her over, and she gets out of the truck, and she comes over, and he says, "Death of ladder cuts this cable, and we just have this chainsaw, so we need to know if it's alive or dead." And she looked at it, and she said, "Oh, it's dead." She got back to the cab of her truck, and he said, "Oh, wait a minute. That's a rather large cord, and I know we look like grapes at this point, but please, could you take another look at it?" So she gets out of the cab, and she goes and looks at the cord, and she says, "Look, I've been working for the power company for 25 years. I should know at this point whether it's alive or dead. I'm telling you, that's not a hot cable. Now, let me get back to my way. Absolutely positive." Okay, so she gets back to the truck and looks at the chainsaw. They bring her back out of the truck. "I'm sorry, but could you cut it for us?" So she looked at it again and she said, "Well, I'm not that sure." I'm emotional thinking about it. I was never that sure. See, what do you do to a person that's going to an elders meeting at night and lying to his board of elders and then goes home and just drinks himself silly trying to downplay that pain, and the person can't rely on the Jesus that they know they don't believe in? It's tough. So know the faith system which you use and be comfortable with it, and then life starts to become very, very joyous sometimes. Main point number two is that intolerance of spiritual differences is both irrational and defining for the intolerant one. Here's a definition of intolerance from physics. Quote, "Leeway or variation from a standard, but permissible deviation from a specified value of structural dimension." So you have a piece of steel and you begin to bend it within the specified value of differentiation, and it will bend and come back and be even stronger than before it was bent. But bend it too far, and we say it's either bent out of shape or actually broken. And when we relate to others in our families, in our community, in our workplace, and there are differences within, as long as within our allowable tolerance levels, we're not bent out of shape. But when it's beyond our ability to allow for variables, then we become bent out of shape, and often they do. So the first sub-point, then, is to look first at the conservative Christian community and then the more liberal community so we can understand each other better. Believers. Manim in Hebrew, since we're in the temple. Manim, believers, because everyone believes in something. Please just know, for the precious conservative Christian, it does hang together. It does hang together. My son is extremely bright, brilliant, very devout, and extremely Pentecostal and charismatic. And we love each other and we get along great because I understand this principle. It hangs together for him. So when someone comes to you and argues that you should agree with them that abortion is killing a human being, they're coming from the position not just of that issue, but of a whole group of things that tie together for them. John 14:6 is a very well-known text in many Western culture Americans. This is in the New American Standard Version. Jesus said, allegedly said, Thomas allegedly, quote, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me." And you can't be in seminary more than 2 weeks to find out that there's not a chance that Jesus ever said that. John, among the four gospel writers, is the only one to record it. John writing at 90 AD, some 60 or 70 years after Jesus' death, literally writing words into Jesus' mouth. He never could have consciously, deliberately thought of himself. There's no way he said those things. But when someone comes to me and says, "If you don't hold Jesus as Savior and Lord, I'm sorry, but you're going to hell," my attitude towards them is not, "Wow, how narrow-minded are you?" I respect that view. But I respect that person because I know for them it's true. I just don't have to believe that the source of their truth is accurate. We believe not just the Hebrew people, Israel, but many other Semitic cultures began the concept of theism. I do not believe, if anyone has none of the other things, I'd be glad to hear after the message, but I have no idea how just pure reason leads anyone to theism. What we saw is that Israel and others that were Semitic went through animism to polytheism to nation-statism and kind of wound their way through finally to monotheism. Let us create man in our image was polytheism first, and finally to monotheism. the idea that the only thing I bring to salvation is faith, and it's not faith in the book, but faith in this God concept, but then the God concept. By the way, a lot of the things that's about me, it's not really true, but, you know, good luck trying to figure out which is and isn't, led many of us to atheism. So when a conservative Christian comes to me and says, with all due respect, I cannot allow for the ordination of gays to the ministry, I respect their view. I think many liberals look back at them and argue that they're narrow-minded or they're being intolerant, but I would challenge us that maybe we're the ones that are being intolerant towards them. I look at them as, to use biblical language, they're contending earnestly for the faith. And for many of them, they're trying to fight for the very fact that they have soul, that they have some kind of existence after death. The second sub-point is more to the conservative believer, and I realize there's not likely to be one here, but we do relate to those who are in that camp, and this would be helpful in your relationship with your family, as is for me and mine. The Bible is very clear, and so is the Quran, that the belief system of the others are not to be tolerated. But the same texts argue that the prisons themselves are to be tolerated. And that distinction is huge. It's not the person who is to be rejected, but it is, according to all monotheistic bases, it is the belief system of others that cannot be tolerated. I have many people that will say to me, for example, well, Mike, you're just intellectually arrogant, because the Bible teaches that if you were just humble enough, God could save your soul and redeem you from the hold that Satan clearly has on you. Precious people of faith, that's exactly what the Bible teaches. So I'm not at all put off by that or defensive about that. I believe they're correct. I don't happen to believe that they're correct in terms of the result, but their argument fits together perfectly. I hear this one a lot. You're afraid of righteousness and moral responsibility. Much like a thief who doesn't hang out at a police station, you don't want to follow the Bible's mandates for morality, therefore you reject the God concept. And I agree that the Old and New Testament are very clear about these things. Obviously, I don't agree on the basis of the truth. So the point is that the acceptance of me as a person I argue for, but I don't expect others with whom I disagree in that regard to accept my belief system. Right? In fact, I would respect them more when they're adamant in rejecting my belief system. And the first or the last of the subpoints here, subpoint number three, is that whether conservative or liberal or somewhere in between, as most people are, we would be able to be tolerant of each other if we recognize it isn't really our differences that causes intolerance. It's, in psychological language, poor boundaries. I'm very, very excited about psychotherapy, and one of the great gifts it gave to humanity in the last, say, 40 years is in family systems work, where they began to use the metaphor, to use postmodern language, of a boundary, and to argue that one's, in Western culture especially, one's beliefs and thoughts and feelings are 100% one's own responsibility and privilege. But, conversely, another person's thoughts, beliefs, and feelings are completely their responsibility and their privilege to control as well. And when that boundary, clear, not rigid, not diffuse, but clear and well-marked, is maintained between people, the relationship can be beautiful, there can be much reciprocal influence between the persons, because it's a boundary issue that's clear. But when it's not, that's when we get into intolerance and problems. Here's a story that illustrates the point. Minister goes to Pastoral Calling and comes up on an old Victorian house in the Riverside area, for example, where you have the gardens and the big plate glass windows, the large wooden doors. And as he's approaching the window, the plate glass window, he sees the television is on. But he knocks at the front door, and he knocks at the front door, and no one comes after a while. So he takes out his business card and he pins on it Revelation 3:20, which happens to say, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone opens the door, I will come into him." Something alleged to have been uttered by Jesus in resurrected form, probably 100 years after his death and alleged resurrection. Well, the next Sunday morning, one of the ladies in the congregation goes through it. He's shaking hands and hands him her business card, which she had jotted down Genesis 3:10. So he quickly goes to the study afterwards and looks up Genesis 3:10, and much to his shock, it said, "I heard thy voice in the garden, and I was naked, so I hid myself." The reason I tell that, I think, cute little story is because almost everything we differ on is just differences of opinion in how we use whatever source of revelation or truth that we believe in. That's all it is, differences. It only becomes a problem when we have diffuse boundaries or rigid boundaries. The last major point is that postmodernism as an epistemology leads to a sound and inclusive tolerance.
And I'm unaware of the different philosophical sophistication of you use. So I'm going to explain the term, and I don't mean this pejoratively, but by epistemology, I mean what we know, how we know it. And by postmodernism, I mean that epistemology, the posit that all human experience is based on story. That there is no such thing as objective truth. That all truth is culturally context, and it was given by story and narrative and folklore, all of what I said earlier. That being the case, and it became the case for me, was literally life-changing. As I sat in a class at getting a master's in counseling to become a therapist, I was telling Dr. Michaels at Cal State University of Fullerton, but it's just a story. It's just a freaking story. Don't you understand? I've got to keep lying to these people. It's just a story. And he said to me, Mike, there's no problem with anything you're saying except the word just. Man, the lights went on. Within weeks, I had a calm and a relaxation about me that it's hard to this day to describe. Because I realized for the first time in many, many years that it is a story, but it's not just a story. But what I believe, secular humanism, is also a story. It's a narrative. It's a way of experiencing the world. It puts us on a level playing field, if you were. The following is a way of illustrating that and kind of bringing this all home. And I call it light bulb changing humor. So it does poke fun at different denominations, but I think in a kind-hearted and good-natured way, and illustrates the point. How many persons from different faith systems does it take to change a light bulb? If you know something about these denominations, it's funny. Presbyterians, none, because God has predestined when the light should be turned on and off. It takes no Roman Catholics to change the light bulb because they use candles. But it takes one charismatic because someone's hands are always near the light bulb. It takes no agnostics because by the time we had decided whether the light bulb really needed changing, a new invention had replaced the light bulb. My son likes this one. It takes 10 Pentecostals. One to change the light bulb while 9 pray against the spirit of darkness. It takes 8 Episcopalians. One to call the electrician, of course. And 7 to say how much they like the old light bulb better. So by the Adventists takes none because Jesus' return is imminent and when he sits upon his throne in glory, there will be no further need of any other source of light. Atheists takes none because we await the inevitable evolution of human consciousness which shall illumine the planet. Non-denominationists, 19. One to change the light bulb. 15 divided into 3 committees of 5 each to get oversight of the light bulb changing process. And the obligatory 3 are run off and start a new church called Jesus is the Only Light We Need Tabernacle. Now this part's spurious, of course. This came from the president of the UU denomination who said, as UUs, we choose not to make a statement for or against the need to change the light bulb. However, if in your personal journey you have found that the light bulb works for you, we validate that crisis. Indeed, Mike, you were invited to write a poem where you told a modern band about your light bulb experience and presented next month at our annual light bulb pottery service. We would explore a number of different light bulb traditions, including incandescent, fluorescent, 3-way, long light bulb, all of which are paths to luminescence. The reason that we appreciate that, we're technically a UU, but I think much like a UU, is because for most of you, whether you use the language or not, you're postmodern in your epistemology. But if you're a modernist in your epistemology and you believe there's an objective truth, what I've just said is ludicrous. It's laughable. My son would look at me and say, God, my dad. Well, of course the people are crazy. Look, they just tolerate anything. Just anything goes. Anything is valid. No, there's only one way that things are valid, and that's why we differ, but we still like each other and love each other. To conclude, in my recovery program, I always get the same reaction. When someone knows me well enough to understand two things. One, I'm fairly spiritual, but I'm an atheist. And I pray, and they usually have that cross-eyed kind of, what? I don't understand. Kind of response. Because the assumption in many Western people's minds is that when one is not a theist, one cannot be spiritual. And of course, obviously now you can see why I disagree with that. I've used different language. For me, prayer is not to a divine source. In psychological language, I'm integrating my observing and my experience itself, but I do pray. And I believe that prayer helps in our ability to be tolerant with one another. So, last story. Similar situation, pastoral call being made, and it was to someone where they the minister of the church and the president of the board were at great odds with each other and had been for a long time. And Tiffany felt it was incumbent upon her as the minister of the church to go and meet with Carl, the president of the congregation, trying to, you know, make amends or make things right. So she went, same situation, large plate glass window through the garden, you know, big wooden door, and there's a steaming cup of coffee sitting there, and she knows Carl's in there, but no matter how much she knocks, he's not answering. I know Carl's in there, he's just mad at me. So she gets down on her knees and she looks through the keyhole. And much to her surprise, there's a big eye looking right back at her. And then she hears Carl's voice. She says, "Dr. Tiffany, this is the first time we've seen eye to eye since you came to our church." But because she was spiritual, she said, "Yeah, Carl. And it's because we're on our knees."